also clarify, how do you pronounce it? Is it Artesanias or Artesanias?
It's easy, Judge. This is Barry Gould. I'm counsel for Artesanias. Think of it as being arty. Artesanias, Hacienda Real S.A. de CV.
Artesanias. Thanks.
Yes.
I'll just call it EHR. Okay, Mr. Golden, you're ready?
Yes, I am. As I start, though, I'd like to reserve four minutes for a reply.
All right.
And it's my hope that since you've requested oral argument that you're going to have questions for us, and I'd like to respond to those and give you as much time as I could. But I did want to begin by reminding you that there are two issues lurking below the surface of what seems to be a standing argument, and I wanted to raise those two issues to you for your collective attention. The first of the two issues is what, for lack of a better, I will call Trust Chapter 7 Trustee Discretion. Under the Bankruptcy Code, the...
Say that again, please, Judge McKee. Say that again.
Yeah, Judge McKee, it's what I call Chapter 7 Trustee Discretion.
Okay.
Because the chapter trustee stands in the place of the debtor or the management of the debtor or the person operating the debtor and is afforded considerable discretion. Mm-hmm. And it's subject, that discretion is, of course, subject to the statutory limits, but it's also subject to the objection of creditors and, more importantly, approval of the bankruptcy court. And the reason I raised that first issue I raised was trustee discretion, and it ties to the second issue, which is finality of the bankruptcy court order. It is critical in a bankruptcy court setting, really for any court, but in particular bankruptcy court, that once it makes its decision and ruling and issues its order, it is a final order. And that's important because the bankruptcy court is typically dealing with property. It is important that anyone coming along afterwards knows that the person who's dealing with the property, the bankruptcy court said this is the proper person to deal with the property, can rely on that.
Yeah, we also have this issue of a cause of action, not just the lien on the real estate, but there's also an issue, isn't there, of causes of action?
Yes. Yes, but I'm not sure would you like to flesh your question out more?
Yeah, well, I'm just not sure where you're going with this. I'm not sure how it's helpful. It seems to me that the biggest problem, at least in my mind, that you have to overcome is how your claims are unique to how your client's claims are unique to your client. Why aren't they the same as the claims of any other creditor of the debtor here? Not the debtor, but the
And the answer to that is really very, very simple. In several respects. The first respect is my client, unlike any other creditor, and there weren't many other creditors, but my client had a judgment lien. It's a secured creditor. And the issue, all the claims arise from the deprivation of its being able to enforce its judgment lien.
But don't you have to show more than that? The fact that you have a priority under the code because you're a judgment creditor doesn't necessarily, as I understand it, take you out of the universe of creditors. The claim you have, it seems to me, is not unique to your client, but it's the kind of claim that any creditor could assert. Now, you have a secured interest because you have a lien, but that does not make your injury unique to your client, does it? This goes to what your client has done to enforce that.
I respectfully believe it does. And let's keep in mind a provision of the code. Section 541 of the code says that the only property that becomes property of the debtor after the bankruptcy is property that was property before.
Mm-hmm.
And my client had a judgment lien on the debtor's property before. That judgment lien continued after the bankruptcy was filed.
Mr. Golden.
Yeah.
Judge Bevis, let me put Judge McKee's concern a different way. At least this is how I see it. A lien and being secured gives you a different ranking within the creditors. But let's imagine that your client recovered $2 million from these suits, more than enough to compensate your injuries. Wouldn't the leftover, isn't it possible that there would be leftover money here that could benefit other creditors? I mean, that's the test we adopted, albeit with a dissent, in Inri Emeril. And if the other creditors could also benefit, I mean, yes, you stand in line first because you're secured, but it doesn't make this claim to the exclusion of the estate as a whole benefiting from it.
Well, that raises an interesting problem.
That's my concern.
Because in this particular case, Liza Witteller, which is the attorney, was the attorney for the debtor and for Mr. Jeffrey, had sent letters to the creditors saying there isn't any other property available. There's no other way you're going to get money.
Okay, you may have said that, but you're asking us to adopt a rule, and the rule we apply has to apply not only when it's Wilk Narmatal is Artesanius is the one big creditor, but in cases where there are dozens or hundreds of creditors. And if we adopt your sense that it doesn't matter, if we blur the sense of what makes it general versus personal, where we take the defense position in Emeril, then that's going to affect a whole bunch of future creditors, too.
5 minutes.
Yes, and my position would be that the fact that there is a priority security interest makes it different.
I'd just like to chime in on that. Why can't we say that if this is, in effect, a fraud on the bankruptcy court, that not only do you have a right, but also all the other creditors also have a right that they've been injured. It's just that your injury is you would, in the disposition of assets, but you have a priority claim. But they, all the creditors, including general unsecured creditors, have been injured by what occurred.
Okay,
have a priority claim on those assets.
Okay, but that brings us to the second problem, which is that in this particular case, there was a compromise, a Rule 9019 compromise with the trustee. It gets back to the issue of the trustee discretion. And the trustee in this case decided that the trustee did not want to pursue those claims, which takes us out of the other kind of Emeril kind of cases. If the trustee doesn't want to take pursue the claims and the secured creditor does, and notice is given to all creditors and no one objects, and the bankruptcy court then issues its final order saying that you can proceed, why doesn't that comply with every purpose of intent of the bankruptcy code?
Well, they're still pursuing Lisa Witteller. So the trustee has not given up.
The trustee is pursuing only the malpractice claims, and rather interestingly, because this happened after after the briefing, the trustee has sought to abandon the claims to the debtor, which would theoretically be absolutely permitted under Section 548 of the Code.
What's the best part of the record that supports your abandonment argument? Can you cite me something in the joint appendix that we can look at?
In the sure. There, and I'm pulling out my pages of the appendix now. If you look at the Chapter Trustee's motion to abandon, that was in the appendix at A466. And then his motion to, and then there's the stipulation for abandonment that was so ordered by the court.
2 minutes.
At A468. the only things that weren't abandoned with that were the malpractice claims. It's the malpractice claims that the trustee now wants to abandon to the debtor. And the objection based on Judge Smith's decision is that they can't even abandon to the debtor.
But it doesn't unequivocally give that authority to Artesanius. Where in here does it unequivocally give it to Artesanius?
It says it defines the claims, and it says that the motion was the original motion entitled Motion to Abandon.
Well, didn't the stipulation and settlement agreement say something to the effect that the trustee would not interfere with the assertion or pursuit of RTC or the debtor of any of the abandoned claims?
Yes. Let's not confuse the two different agreements. The first was the compromise agreement, and that was the settlement agreement at beginning at page 8239.
Okay.
And the last page of it, the next stack of pages is 8246. I believe you're referring to the last sentence of section 17.
Yes, that's great. Yeah.
Now, if you remember, there was dialogue in front of a colloquy in front of Judge Failing as to this very provision, and it was as during that dialogue that I specifically asked, we're not foreclosed from pursuing the district court case that we have.
All right. So that might either be abandonment or estoppel because North Mill's lawyer was there.
Correct.
But how does that operate against Leibovitz?
Well, it did in the sense that he was abandoning all claims. Well, in this compromise in Section 17, you notice it specifically mentions Leibovitz Heller.
Counsel's time has expired.
It says which HR may have against Northville, Leibovitz Heller, Ivan Jeffrey, and so on.
But the trustee is still pursuing claims against Leibovitz Heller.
You
say it's only malpractice and breach of contract.
Correct.
But, you know, the trustee... What would you say about the idea that the trustee has discretion about which legal theories to pursue against Leibovitz Heller and which not? Are you saying every time the trustee chooses to pursue some legal theories, Artesanius, it's abandoned everything else to Artesanius to pursue?
If that's what the trustee chooses to do, and what he chose to do was to abandon those claims that were already being pursued by Artesanius. Remember, Artesanius had filed its complaint against Leibovitz Heller and North Mill months before the bankruptcy filing. The complaint and then the amended complaint had been provided to the trustee, and the trustee simply said, I don't want to pursue them. Those are the claims I'm interested in. And he allowed Artesanius to pursue them. And that was the subject of the colloquy in front of the bankruptcy court. No one objected to Artesanius pursuing. That was part of the compromise agreement. So what we're getting to part of that, which is why I raised the issue of trustee discretion. Here the trustee has exercised his discretion. He doesn't want to pursue the claims. He announces that. It's discussed at the compromise hearing. Notice has been given to everybody. The bankruptcy court says, okay, fine, you can go ahead and pursue the claims. A final order is issued. And then after the fact, after we've been induced to enter into this compromise agreement, after the fact, months later, there will be an argument made, well, no, the trustee couldn't do that. But we already have a final order by then. Which is part of my concern is, if this isn't a final order, then any property can be, someone can come back later and say, well, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a final order or not.
Your position is that you have the right to pursue your cause of action in the district court, and any other creditor would also have a, likewise, would have a cause of action, would they not?
No, because they didn't enter into the compromise agreement with the trustee, and they didn't have, with respect to Liza Witzeller, they didn't have an abandonment order. Again, that gets back to the issue of the compromise and the abandonment that's made by the trustee. It's very specific, and it's proven. In both cases, it's ordered by the court. Nobody else has those, nor could anyone get them. So really, it gets back to the point I made before. It is about the trustee's discretion in what he can do to make a compromise, what he can do to abandon, and then the consequence of the statements made in the court on the record and the court's final order. And what we're seeing here is an attempt to open up that final order in a different proceeding. Now, I don't know whether I've answered your question or not. I hope I have.
You mentioned mine. This is Judge McKee. This is the issue here. An abuse of discretion on the part of the trustee, an error of law on the part of the trustee.
I don't think the trustee made any error. The trustee has the ability to compromise, and the trustee has the ability to abandon. I think the issue is in terms of the subsequent proceedings in court. Unfortunately, Judge Felling had retired. He recused himself and then retired. Mm-hmm. I don't think we would have had the same result if he'd been still on the bench, because he would have gone back and said, I already said this.
Why couldn't he just appeal the decision of the trustee in bankruptcy and say it's inequitable, you had a lien, and you walked away with practically nothing, and you would have been a priority, had priority if the time gone, according to the way it usually goes. Your proper proceeding, why wouldn't it have been to appeal the trustee's decision when he entered into this agreement and say, no, it's improper because you had a priority lien and you've been dealt away with your priority lien by this agreement?
This was a compromise agreement we entered into. This is an agreement between Artisanius and the trustee. We were willing to do that so that one piece of valuable real estate could be sold. There was a bidder. And it was a good bid. So we entered an agreement with the trustee to permit him to sell. But part of the compromise, in order to get that agreement with the trustee, was that we would be permitted to pursue these claims that had already been filed and were in the district court. That's why it's a rule.
What happened to the after it was closed? You say it was closed. When the trustee proceeded with the closing, what happened after that?
After the real estate approximately a month later, after the compromise agreement was approved by the bankruptcy court, the real estate was sold. The proceeds were later distributed, and with the approval of the trustee, we continued to pursue our claims in district court, which is exactly what was contemplated as contemplated in the compromise agreement called the settlement agreement. It was exactly as contemplated in the bankruptcy court proceeding. It was exactly as contemplated by the bankruptcy court order. It was just the way it was supposed to be. That was what we had agreed to.
Well, you have no more real estate upon which to assert a priority claim. Of real estate has been sold free and clear of your claim, I take it.
That was part of the compromise agreement, yes. We gave up the lien so that the real estate could be sold.
Well, then why did you give up the lien? You didn't give up the lien. You would have had the proceeds from the sale would have satisfied the lien.
Because North Mill and Artisanius were both claiming liens which exceeded because of the conflict between North Mill and Artisanius as to their liens, the property couldn't be sold unless we both agreed to a compromise agreement, which is what happened.
Well, I do agree, in effect now, is that you agreed to but on the condition that you be allowed to proceed your cause of action in the district court.
Absolutely, you have it.
Well, why can't we say that? In other words, there was no fraud on the bankruptcy court here. You agreed to proceeding. The only question is, you say there is no question that it was agreed that you would proceed with your district court lawsuit after the money was sold, the real estate was sold. Although, how are you going to realize any benefit from that sale if the money had been dispersed, I take at that point?
Part of the money was dispersed to North Mill. Part of the money was dispersed to Artisanius. Part of the money was dispersed to the trustee to pay his costs, and part of it was paid to the trustee for his fee.
Well, you only got peanuts out of that. You didn't get what you could have gotten for the entire amount of your judgment claim.
That's part of what we gave up in the compromise in order to be able to continue pursuing the claim against North Mill and Lazarus Tower. So, yes, you're correct. There was, you see, the issue in between North Mill and Artisanius was an issue of priority and amount.
Yeah.
And if we could have litigated that for years, but someone would have had to take care of the property, which was vacant. Someone would have had to pay the...
What kind of property was this?
It was an office building, actually a beautiful office building that had been essentially abandoned. There was no one in it. The real estate taxes weren't being paid. The utilities weren't being paid. And then there was a critical problem. This was a beautiful wood building. The fire preventive devices weren't working. The fire code people were in arms, and insurance was about to be canceled. We had to deal with it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Does that account for the reason for the...
It's agreed that the value...
Go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead, Bob. Yeah, your basic agreement is, by reason of a settlement agreement you had, that they agreed that you would be allowed to proceed with your claim to the proceeds and that's why you agreed to the sale, because and the two, Heller and the other party, would be liable for anything that the district court comes up with.
Correct.
And the urgency for the sale is why, because I hadn't seen that before. Looking at this, the value of the agreed value of the property was tied to the extent to which the sale could be accelerated.
The appraised value of the property had been almost $900,000. The property was in deteriorating condition, and we had a buyer that was willing to pay $800,000 for it. And as I indicated, the liens, the real estate taxes weren't being paid. Wilton Armitage was out of business. There was no money to pay. I personally had to arrange for the grass to be cut, and I was personally having to go out there to take care of things. But we were faced with the fact that the insurance was about to cancel, and the township was coming over all over us because the fire prevention wasn't working.
Well, why didn't you provide in the agreement that upon the sale of the real estate, the money would be paid into the bankruptcy court held by the trustee until you and the other parties determined who's entitled to what part of it?
That was the alternate that we were had discussed, and it was not something the trustee was interested in. The trustee wanted it all simple, clean, done. We had to get it. We had to have some kind of an arrangement between us and between North Mill so that the property could be sold.
All right. So it's an issue of
trustee discretion.
So now you want North Mill and Heller to pay back what you think after litigation that you would be entitled to, but more than you received.
Correct. Or to make good the loss.
All right. and the specific part of the trustee's agreement that allowed you to, that all the parties agreed for that you say, your position that you were allowed to go ahead with your lawsuit is what?
It was... Yes, it was the Clause 17 of the Compromise Agreement. That's item one. Item two, the colloquy on the record, because I would not have proceeded but for that colloquy on the record, in which North Mill said, yes, you can go ahead with a district court case.
North Mill was at the colloquy, but Lazarus Keller was not represented at the colloquy.
Correct. But they had the opportunity to be present, and they're specifically mentioned in the clause in Section 17. And the rule in the bankruptcy court is, you show up, if you have a problem, you object. If you don't, you waive your objection. And then the bankruptcy court approved. Now, with respect to Lysowitz Heller, to make it clear later, we have the subsequent abandonment agreement that I pointed out to you. In A-466 and A-468 and continuing. So we have both the compromise with respect to them and also a specific abandonment agreement.
But it's abandoned, but it doesn't say whether it's abandoned to Wilton or to Artisanius. It just says we abandon them.
Yes, and abandonment by law is to the pre-petition possessor. It gets back to the cryogenics case that we mentioned in response to your letter. In the Third Circuit, the court said, look, the creditor claim is a creditor claim. It doesn't become property of the estate. It's merely that the trustee has the power to deal with it.
Well, that...
And when it's abandoned, it reverts back to the pre-petition possessor. So in cryogenics, they said the trustee couldn't sell the claim to anyone else, the creditor's claim to anyone else, because it belonged to the creditor.
Is the claim, it sounds like this is just another way of saying what we were talking about earlier, that whether the claim is fundamentally just Artisanius' claim, or is it that Northville and Lysowitz Heller were plundering the debtor as a whole? And if the latter is the case, then it's not clear to me that it, under that logic, that it goes back to one of the people who was injured, because it seems like the wrong is really a wrong of plundering Wilton.
But an abandonment under 548, the trustee has the power, has the discretion to abandon any property if he no longer believes it to be beneficial to the estate.
Right, but that doesn't answer the question, abandoned to whom?
Yeah.
It abandons to the pre-petition possessor.
That goes back to the same question. Whose claim is it? It's just another way of getting it, but logically it's just a different flavor of this. Is this really an individual personal claim, or is it a general claim?
With all due respect, under a fraudulent transfer claim, for instance, belongs to the creditor.
Mm-hmm.
Only a creditor can assert it, and it's that creditor's claim. Assume for a minute that there wasn't a bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that there had never been a bankruptcy, and Artisanius was realistically the only major creditor of Wilton the debtor.
Mm-hmm.
Artisanius then could have pursued its fraudulent transfer claim as its creditor, as a creditor. He doesn't have to call up all the other creditors and say, hey, guys, are you in with me? It's claim under statute.
But isn't it true that the fact of the fraudulent transfer reduces the value of the bankrupt estate? it reduces that which is available for any creditor to collect from. So why is it then a loss unique to your client as opposed to...
At that point, it's a decision simply by the bankruptcy trustee that he doesn't wish, it's a he in this case, doesn't wish to pursue the claim. And he makes a motion in the bankruptcy court under Section 548. And creditors are given notice. Nobody objects. And the bankruptcy court issues an order, which is now a final order. So what I'm in a loss to understand at this point with a final order is why would we even be discussing that? That decision is passed. It's over the hill. It's done. And it gets back to the issue of once the property is abandoned by final order, the person to whom it's abandoned has to be able to pursue. Otherwise, abandoned property could be subject to question forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we get back to the comment I began with. We have the two issues of trustee discretion and final order. If these orders aren't final orders, what is and what are you going to do with the consequences?
Basically, the trustee could have pursued this claim himself. But your position is he didn't, and it was abandoned, therefore it's yours to go forward with.
Correct. That kind of has to be. That's clear reading of the code,
mm-hmm.
on the one hand, but it's also the intent of bankruptcy, which is to turn assets into usable value if you can, if the trustee makes the decision that the trustee doesn't want to pursue it and decides to abandon it because he's not interested in abandoning it, but because someone else is, namely the creditor who had the claim to begin with, that's the purpose of the bankruptcy code, to allow these assets to be turned into value somehow, or at least the possibility of value, and to achieve a final decision so that it can be done.
Well, you know, in cybergenics, we concluded that the fraudulent transfer claims were abandoned to the individual creditors, like Arkansian, when we pointed out in the cybergenics ruling that such claims really belong to all the creditors, though, don't they? Not just you.
Not once they're abandoned. Once they're abandoned, they go back to who? If your question is, could the trustee have abandoned someone claims to someone else if they asked for it? Of course, but nobody else did. Nobody else was interested. Yeah. To be very blunt, nobody else had enough. The claims were very minor. Nobody cared.
Yeah. So, so that you're saying as a matter of law that this was agreed to by all the parties, including the trustee, and in effect, what's all a shooting about?
Yes. You got it.
Right.
And not only is what all the shooting about, but it's what are the consequences if a final order isn't a final order?
Well, that answers my question that I started with in terms of why is this not a general claim of the estate, and I think you responded to that in this dialogue.
Okay. If there are no other questions, then...
I have none.
Nope, that's good.
Okay, are my 4 minutes still reserved, or have we used them?
Sure, no, the fact that we go over your time, you reserved for rebuttal, that's your rebuttal. We didn't,
okay.
We didn't forfeit that.
Good.
Just
thank you.
Pocket.
Thank you.
As a result, we will let Mr. Foster and Mr. McCarran have a bit more time if they really need it. Mr. Foster, are you going first, I think?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm ready to proceed.
Okay. Tell me why Mr. Golden's wrong about this.
Certainly, Your Honor. So may it please the Court, my name is Tim Foster from the firm Stamsky Israel PC. I'm arguing on behalf of the appellee North Mill Capital, LLC. So, Your Honors, as found by both the bankruptcy court and the district court below, Artesanias Hacienda Real S.A. de C.V., which I call AHR, has no standing that would enable it to bring the claims it asserts against North Mill and Lysoa Teller in this action. AHR, as a judgment creditor, I'm sorry, was that a question?
No, please, finish your introduction.
As a judgment creditor of the debtor, AHR has no recourse to North Mill or Lysoa Teller for the harm alleged, which, as is presented in the amended complaint, would have impacted only the debtor, Wilson, directly. AHR's claims stem from a purported scheme between North Mill, Lysowitz, and Wilton's principal, Ivan Jeffrey, the alleged end result of which was the sale of Wilton's assets at a below-market price, thereby reducing the overall value of Wilton. The only injury alleged by AHR is that the purported sale of Wilton's assets now make it more difficult for AHR to recover full value on its judgment claim against Wilton. AHR doesn't allege any privity or pre-existing relationship with North Mill or Lysowitz, and because the only entity could have been harmed from the alleged conduct of North Mill and Lysowitz was Wilton, and because any harm ultimately befalling AHR as a result of that alleged conduct would impact all the other creditors of Wilton equally, AHR lacks the requisite constitutional standing to bring these claims.
Mr. Foster, Judge Bevis here. You just said constitutional standing, but your argument doesn't support it, especially post-Lexmark. Earlier, you were talking about privity or relationship. Now, that might be right. That might be a limitation of the bankruptcy code. This sounds like it's really arguing about whether was the injury inflicted on the creditors as a whole, on such as the estate or a particular one. But when you say constitutional standing, the requirements for constitutional standing or a jurisdiction are very minimal. I mean, a single person who says, I occasionally go to a national park to watch birds is enough. You know, the indirect harm that's going to flow to that person for not being able to go visit Yosemite next year is enough. So I don't think you could say that because Wilton has a claim, therefore Artesanias doesn't have a claim, but that's a constitutional minimum. I mean, lots of different people get claims constitutionally. So post-Lexmark, isn't that just the wrong way to look at it as a constitutional jurisdictional requirement?
Your Honor, so as you point out, there are three requirements for constitutional standing. The plaintiff must show, and it is the plaintiff's burden to show, an injury in fact, a sufficient causal connection between the injury and the conduct complained of, and
right.
The likelihood that the injury will be redressed by a favorable decision. And while those aspects have been held as minimal, it's not as if any person going to court for any reason can meet those requirements. And those requirements.
I'm having difficulty hearing you. I don't know what happened to your phone connection.
It's a bit broken up.
I'm sorry. Is this better?
This is much better.
Yeah.
Okay. So the requirements may be characterized by some decisions as minimal in nature, but they do exist for a reason. It's not as though any person, for any reason, can go to court argue a case.
But I'm not aware of any case that says the Constitution requires privity or a contractual relationship. On the contrary, lots of non-contractual relationships with no privity that have ripple effects allow indirect as well as direct victims to sue, as long as there's injury in fact, causation, and redressability. And the causation can be a step or two removed if it's sufficiently concrete. So what you said earlier is in tension with the argument you're making now, I think, that this is really constitutionally required.
I see where the potential misunderstanding happened here, Your Honor. By raising the issues of privity or a pre-existing relationship, I wasn't meaning to make that any sort of basis for my argument. What I'm doing is just narrowing down the issue to foreclose any issue that this is that there's a pre-existing contractual or other relationship between the parties here. The only real issue here is whether or not Artesanias has the requisite standing to pursue these claims. And our argument is that they lack the injury in fact required to constitutionally bring these claims. This has been interpreted by courts, including the Third Circuit, several times.
Cases that you cite, doesn't Lexmark clarify this?
Well, Your Honor, the way we read Lexmark is a clarification. They're not saying that what has been historically termed as prudential standing no longer exists or isn't a valid analysis when you're talking about constitutional standing. What Lexmark really did in our reading is to narrow things down and focus everything back to the original three constitutional standing requirements, but to put those through a filter and say there may be certain times where the historically characterized analysis of prudential standing is looked at through the same lens. So when we're dealing with the issue of third-party claims, for instance, those third-party claims don't exist under most circumstances because the third-party claimant, you know, somebody can't raise the claims of another party because the claimant in that case would lack the injury in fact or the sufficient causal connection or the likelihood of redressability that are required to maintain constitutional standing and the jurisdiction of the court.
Counsel, this is Judge Cowan. Let me just ask you a question, getting away from the standing argument. You've got to agree, don't you, at the very least, that the settlement and carve-out agreement did not waive or settle any claims that Artesian otherwise had a right to bring. You've got to agree that. Is that correct?
I agree with you completely, Your Honor. Nothing in the settlement agreement. Bankruptcy court.
All right, so they did not waive or settle any claims that Artesian had. Okay, given that fact, then, don't you agree that what was said to give the parties of the bankruptcy resort to accept the settlement and carve out, does that preclude you from contesting Artesian's right to bring its claim? And if they bring the claim, and you say it's not a bona fide claim, you can make a 12B6 motion or whatever, but you acknowledged at the settlement in the bankruptcy court that they have a right to bring its claim.
Your Honor, the settlement in the bankruptcy court didn't waive or resolve anybody's claims or defenses or arguments in the federal court at all. If you look at the very integration clause that Mr. Golden cited when he was arguing, this is clause paragraph number 17 of the settlement agreement on page A246 of the appendix. It specifically says that this agreement is not intended to and does not release, waive, restrict, limit, or otherwise prejudice any rights, claims, or interests which AHR may have against North Mill, like the Witteller, Ivan Jeffrey, et cetera. What this did was just preserve any rights that already existed or inured to AHR from the beginning. It did not create any new rights. It didn't waive them. And we're not arguing that AHR's claims in this action are foreclosed in any way by this bankruptcy settlement agreement. We've never argued that. And the lower courts didn't rely on that argument either.
Tip against you when you consider what happened in the settlement process together with what you were saying in the mandamus proceeding? That, they could go forward with this thing.
I don't believe that anybody said that in a way that waived any rights, Your Honor, to the extent that what was said during the bankruptcy colloquy was that AHR could continue with its claims in the federal court. All that meant was that nothing that was happening in the bankruptcy court, and Judge Failing actually clarified this, he said specifically that nothing that was happening that day in the bankruptcy court affected the federal court case in any way. And we agree with that. We've never relied on what happened in the bankruptcy court when we're dealing with whether or not AHR has standing to bring these claims in federal court. We looked at it as a completely separate inquiry. It's an independent action. It's an independent judgment. But nothing that happened in the bankruptcy court foreclosed AHR from bringing these claims in federal court, and we're not arguing that. But conversely, nothing that happened in the bankruptcy court waived or prevented North Mill or Leisowitz from defending themselves or objecting or bringing any meritorious arguments that they had against the claims that were being proffered by AHR in federal court.
And your position that they don't have standing to sue you or is based on what? And sum it up again for me. It's pretty tight, right? All right, but...
Certainly, Your Honor. So the issue is that AHR lacks standing because the injury that they are complaining of, which was the reduction in value of assets of Wilton, was felt only by Wilton. It doesn't belong. It wasn't felt by or to AHR directly.
All right, I want to build on that because your friend, Mr. Golden, just said, well, what about fraudulent transfer claims? Your argument then would seem to be that no creditor could bring fraudulent transfer claims.
Well, certainly not once the debtor goes into bankruptcy, Your Honor. Those claims belong to and can only be asserted by the estate or its trustee. The law is very clear on that.
His argument is these belong to the creditor beforehand. If there's an abandonment, they go back to that creditor. And yet your logic would seem to suggest, nope, no standing, nothing. They're out of it.
Because the trustee, the estate or the trustee is the proper party to bring those. And if the trustee determines that for whatever reason those claims aren't meritorious or shouldn't be brought, that's within the trustee's power and discretion to determine.
Then what happens to the claim? That's the problem. Once the trustee abandons claim for whatever reason, where does it go? Does it just disappear? No one has it?
Your Honor, I beg your pardon. Go ahead. Answer judge's question. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Certainly, Your Honor. So even if the claim had been abandoned to AHR in this case, in other words, even if the trustee's intent was to somehow assign or allow AHR the right to assert these claims as a matter of assignment or whether or not it's an asset or property of the estate, that still doesn't convey standing. The trustee doesn't have the authority to convey standing to sue.
What's your authority for that assertion? The trustee can convey a piece of property, and if a person gets a black acre, no question that... You can get that. So why is this not a chosen action that the trustee can assign, just like Blackacre?
Again, Your Honor, it goes back to constitutional standing. The courts can only hear a case where there's an active case or controversy, and in order to do that, the plaintiff must show it's the plaintiff's burden to establish that it has standing to bring the claim. And where that standing doesn't exist, no assignment of the claim can create it out of whole cloth.
Is your argument, harkens me back to research I did years ago dealing not with this, in which years ago no one could sue anyone unless you had what you called a privity of contract. It went out. There had to be only between two contracting parties. And as Judge Vargas just alluded to a few minutes ago, that would do away with all these concepts of where someone is defrauded but was not party to the fraud, could not sue, fraudulent conveyances and other areas. And you have the same thing here. Even though he's not a party to it, that doesn't mean he wasn't affected by it. And if he was affected and legal rights were diminished, why wouldn't he have standing? It doesn't have to be the, I'll go back, privity of contract between the two parties. So that goes back to the old caveat emptor era.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the courts have tried to wrestle with this issue for decades, and what it always comes back to is the injury in fact analysis. The party who was harmed in the first instance directly by the complaint of conduct is the proper party to bring the claim. It's the only party.
Why is that EHR? After the abandonment by the trustee, why isn't that party EHR?
Because, Your Honor, the claim, the damage complained of, if it exists at all, would be felt equally by all of the creditors.
Well, they're all injured. It's not that none are injured. It's that they're all injured and all have injury in fact standing. There may be a bankruptcy-specific reason why the trustee statutorily ordinarily exercises that, but after they've abandoned it constitutionally, they've all suffered.
Yeah, the fact that all people have standing doesn't mean that any one of that universe doesn't have standing. It just means others may have it also.
Your logic would seem to be if you injure enough people, you can't sue on it.
Yeah. Injure everybody and you're free. You get a walk.
No, Your Honor, but it's only the individual party who is injured directly by the complaint of conduct that has the standing to sue. So, for instance, in this case, if all of the creditors of Wilton were allowed to sue in an individual capacity, again, I'll go back to the issue that this is not a derivative action. In the case law, when creditors are allowed to bring this kind of claim by virtue of damage that has allegedly been done to the debtor, they can only do it as a derivative claim. They bring it on behalf of the estate for the benefit of all of the creditors. That's not what EHR is trying to do here. And the reason
because the trustee abandoned the claim, they can't do it here.
Mr. Falter, I think this is a very helpful discussion with Judge Bevis because the gap between your constitutional position and the statutory understanding of bankruptcy, I'll put standing in quotation marks, is that your position seems to be no one else can ever sue except the bankruptcy trustee. And if we accept the constitutional position, yes, but then you're saying a whole lot of people who've been injured nevertheless don't count as injury in fact because they're not direct and they don't have privity, which I'm just not aware of a case that's on all fours. Maybe you can cite me one. But the other position would seem to say, yes, in the first instance, the statutory bankruptcy code assigns that power to the trustee, but then logically, if this is not a constitutional problem, if the bankruptcy trustee can abandon it, can release it, can transfer it, just like he can transfer an IOU or a bond or a chosen action. So I'd like to know, do you have any authority for this proposition that the indirectly harmed people lack constitutional injury in fact? What case?
Well, Your Honor, so In re Emeril, I think, is at least instructive on this point. It doesn't speak to it exactly directly, but I think the reason that the case law has developed in the way it has is to prevent multiple parties from suing the same defendant on the same issue. So, for instance, here, if AHR is correct and its claims are allowed to go forward, then that subjects North Mill and Lysowitz Heller to the same claims being made from all of the estate's creditors. And if the estate had determined that it had claims against them, in fact, it did because it's pursuing claims against Lysowitz Heller, and it had asserted claims against North Mill, which were resolved in the settlement agreement that was reached in the bankruptcy court, that would subject North Mill and Lysowitz or any other party in their similar position in any other bankruptcy to basically unlimited liability for any argument by a creditor of the debtor that the actions of those parties in any way diminished the value of the estate. It would subject them to not only unlimited and multiple liabilities, but it would also put those creditors in direct competition with the trustee for the same recovery. If the trustee determines in their discretion that the claims are not meritorious or worth pursuing for some reason, then that's within the trustee's purview. The trustee is the representative of the debtor and also has fiduciary duties to do the best job it can to recover assets for the estate for the benefit of the creditors. It acts on behalf of the estate, and if it determines that the claims aren't meritorious, then to some extent I think the case law suggests that the creditors have to live with the trustee's decision in many respects.
Yeah, but there was a stipulation and settlement agreement here in which the trustee indicated he would not interfere with Artensian's suit suit against you or Heller.
That's
the stipulation and settlement.
But the language of that document is similar to the language I pointed out earlier in the settlement agreement. All it did was say that any claims that AHR may already have, the trustee isn't going to interfere with. It didn't say, I hereby give AHR new claims that it never had before or new standing that didn't exist for previously. It just says that the trustee isn't going to foreclose any meritorious claims that AHR may already have. It's very similar to the language and effect of the first settlement agreement between the parties and the bankruptcy court. It didn't foreclose or waive anything. It just said the parties can continue with whatever claims, you know, already exist to the extent they exist. It didn't create anything new, and it didn't foreclose or preclude anything that was already valid.
Well, it said that the trustee would not interfere with the assertion or pursuit of Artensian's or the debtor's or any other abandoned claims. So I don't know. It sounds like that's a good – your argument maybe could be made in the district court. It doesn't make much – oh.
Correct. And Your Honor, the district court judge addressed this pretty squarely in saying that whatever the trustee says, you know, cannot create new rights as a matter of law. If the trustee is wrong about its interpretation of the law or the nature of the claims or the operations of the courts, that's not entitled, you know, that's not a precedential decision. It's not entitled to deference or any weight necessarily, and it certainly can't create new legal rights where none existed before.
Abandoned the claim and at the same time said he would not interfere with the assertion of Artensian's claim. I mean, how much clearer do they have to have the writing on the wall?
But again, Your Honor, if AHR did not have standing to bring the claims in the first place, then those claims didn't validly exist regardless of whether or not the trustee decided that he wanted to interfere with them or not.
Why would the trustee have brought these claims in the first place instead of abandoning them to our TG? Why couldn't the trustee have brought these claims?
Well, the trustee could have brought these claims, Your Honor, and if the trustee had brought these claims on behalf of the debtor, then we would be having a different discussion right now. In fact, the trustee did pursue these claims against North Mill, and they were resolved as to the debtor in the settlement agreement. So North Mill already had to deal with the claim.
All right, but he had this claim. The trustee, as you say, could have pursued it. He didn't. He abandoned it. At the same time, said he would not interfere with Artensian's pursuit of the claim. I mean, I don't know how much we have to spell out.
Mr. Foster, I'd like to hear you follow up. You know, your main line of argument is there's no claim here in the first place. There's no constitutional standing. And by the way, the trustee can't abandon anything to anyone who didn't have it to begin with. But I do think you kind of implied that, well, a creditor would have had a fraudulent transfer claim before the bankruptcy, but then once there is a bankruptcy, it's the trustee's claims. I'd like to know, why is it that if the creditor could have brought this before bankruptcy, that he can't abandon it back? And the other point I'd like to know about is I've heard you say nothing that precludes the application of estoppel if there is a claim. Your responses have been entirely that there is no claim. But Judge Cowan asked you about estoppel. I didn't hear you argue anything that would prevent an estoppel if there is a claim that could be brought.
So I'll address your second part of that question first, Your Honor. So as far as estoppel or waiver goes, again, this goes back in part to the language of the settlement agreement that Mr. Golden alluded to, which only says that it doesn't waive or foreclose any claims that Artisanius may have against
right.
North Mill Isolatello. There's nothing else in the record that points to any concept of waiver or estoppel. There's nothing that AHR can...
In Joint Appendix 234 to 236 is the, what is that, the 1919 conference, where your counsel will go on and say, yes, absolutely, they're free to pursue, they can go forward with what they've got in federal court by all means. So it's unaffected by the settlement agreement. It's just you're relying on there not being a claim in the first place.
Well, and Your Honor, to some extent, yes. I mean, we are not relying on anything that happened in the bankruptcy court as any assertion that it foreclosed any claims that AHR may have already had. If AHR had claims or standing to begin with, then nothing that happened in the bankruptcy court foreclosed AHR from bringing those claims. We've never argued that. We've never argued that AHR waived anything by virtue of the proceedings in the bankruptcy court. The statements that were made in the colloquy before the bankruptcy court were consistent with the interpretation of the language of the settlement agreement.
Wait a second. But the problem I have is you've taken the position earlier that the trustee can't abandon things back to AHR Artisanius. And now you're saying, you thought you could bring this claim, but actually by abandoning it, it just got extinguished. Too tough for you. You were too foolish to see this. So that position you took earlier sounds inconsistent with the idea that, absolutely, they're free to go ahead with whatever there is. You're now arguing that the abandonment amounts to an extinguishment, which you doesn't look like that's what you said at the Rule 9019 hearing.
Well, Your Honor, one quick point about the 9019 hearing is that when the carve-out was being discussed, we specifically said that nothing. So if you look on page A235, the mm-hmm. statement by Mr. Israel was that there was nothing going on in the bankruptcy court that would affect what was going on in the federal court. Starting at line 7, mm-hmm. Mr. Israel said they could go forward with, we don't see a long tail to that, but they could go forward with what they've got in federal court by all means. What that meant was exactly what paragraph 17 of the settlement agreement says, where they can go forward with whatever claims they may have in federal court, but his statement that we don't see a long tail to that specifically alluded to the idea that we planned to bring a motion to dismiss those claims because we didn't think they had any merit.
Right. Okay, but Mr. Goldman, 19 and 20, says it isn't compromised by the North Mill carve-out agreement. Well, by anything that happened today, fine. So that would seem to suggest that the settlement agreement doesn't extinguish the claims against North Mill.
And again, Your Honor, that's correct. We've never argued that the settlement agreement extinguished any claims AHR may have already had against North Mill. Our argument is independent of the settlement agreement. We've never relied on the settlement agreement for anything, and neither did the lower courts. Neither the bankruptcy court nor the district court relied on anything that happened in the bankruptcy court or any of the language in the settlement agreement as part of their reasoning in determining that AHR lacked standing to pursue these claims against North Mill and Mysoa Teller.
Okay.
Going to the first part of your question earlier, let me just clarify quickly my position as far as the abandonment issue. The position is not that the trustee can never abandon a claim to anybody for any reason. The position is merely that the trustee cannot assign or abandon a claim to a person who lacks the requisite standing to bring it. If I'm in an automobile accident that's somebody else's fault, I can't sign a document that assigns the right to bring those claims to my uncle who lives in Arizona, who had nothing to do and wasn't even present for the accident. He can't bring those claims as a plaintiff for his own individual recovery. There may be limited circumstances where he would be authorized to bring that on my behalf if I were disabled in some way, you know, and had signed a power of attorney or something like that. But there's no circumstance where he would be allowed to bring those claims as a plaintiff directly against the other driver who injured me because he lacks the constitutional standing to do so. And that's exactly the kind of argument we're dealing with here. Artisanius was not directly injured by any of the conduct it's complaining of between North Mill, Leisowitz, and Ivan Jeffrey. It was Wilton that was harmed by that, and because that conduct, if it hurt anybody at all, would have hurt Wilton and all of his creditors equally, then AHR doesn't have the individualized, particularized, concrete injury that's required to convey constitutional standing to it.
Okay, any other questions at all?
That's it for me.
Okay, if not, we can hear from your colleague who is taking to the part.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
I'm here. Jeffrey McCarron on behalf of Witt Teller and the two lawyers, Eden Bucher and Charles Phillips. Your Honors have been patiently listening and, of course, scribbling at the same time. And I hope to put the thinking on the correct track with respect to at least the clause of Witt Teller and its two lawyers. Let's just remember that the action was commenced by AHR at a point in time that was prior to the bankruptcy. But once the bankruptcy was filed, whatever standing or claim to standing that AHR had was completely lost, unless, as has already been discussed, there was particularized harm. I mean, that's the standard to allow a creditor to pursue a claim outside of the bankruptcy that doesn't, on the basis that it doesn't belong to the trustee. Importantly, that test is particularized harm, and it relates to the nature and extent of the relief. It's not particularized claim. So whatever AHR had was lost once the bankruptcy was filed, and I don't, from what I can tell from listening for over an hour now, the court is well acquainted with the idea about particularized harm and accepts the idea that the harm was not unique to AHR because it's not subject to a formula, it doesn't depend on priority or the outcome of a math problem about whether assets would have been left for other creditors. So AHR had no standing once the bankruptcy was filed in the absence of, and I think that the plaintiff depends on this, in the absence of some manner in which it obtained standing, and obviously not because it had particularized harm. The First Amendment complaint, which is the basis for this action, does not describe any basis for standing once the bankruptcy was filed. So all that we're talking about has to do with activity that occurred after this action got underway and is not information that was in front of the court. Now, I understand that plaintiff is dependent on a stipulation that the court realizes Elizabeth Teller had nothing whatsoever to do with. But importantly, let's look at the stipulation. The stipulation says...
Where are you in the JA4?
I don't have the...
468, I think.
Okay. The stipulation says the claims, as defined in 11 U.S.C. Section 1015, which the Wilton trustee abandons, and then it goes on and says, to the debtor. There's nothing in the stipulation that abandons anything whatsoever to AHR. This stipulation is limited to abandoning claims to the debtor. AHR is not the debtor. It then goes on and does not abandon any claim whatsoever, any claim at all against Liza Witzella or the two lawyers. In fact, it says that it is not abandoning the negligence slash professional liability and breach of contract claims. And what I understand that AHR is contending is that there's the absence of mention about any other claim means that the trustee meant to abandon any other claim against Lizowitz Heller. I don't see how, it's not possible for the court to reach that conclusion. The district court didn't reach
that. But the stipulation and settlement agreement expressly stated that the trustee would interfere with the assertion or pursuit by Artesian or the debtor of any of the abandoned claims.
But it didn't abandon the claim, Your Honor. There's nothing to support the idea that the trustee abandoned the claims against Lizowitz Heller. And here's the
important point. Well, he didn't go forward with them.
It certainly did. It absolutely 100% went forward with the claims. The trustee asserted claims against Lizowitz Heller and the two lawyers. Forget about the titles of the causes of action. It is pursuing the exact same form of relief as is being pursued in this action. So that's
why there's no adjudication of that claim, though.
There's no adjudication. Well, this standing requirement can't possibly mean that a creditor can pursue the exact form of relief as the trustee against the same parties. They can't. So Lizowitz Heller is facing double liability because of the claims that are being asserted. And the reason they can't is because that's why you have to have the abandonment. But there hasn't been an abandonment. There's no writing that they depend on to support the idea that the trustee expressly indicated an abandonment of a claim against Lizowitz Heller.
2 minutes.
The trustee is pursuing a claim against Lizowitz Heller. It is pursuing the exact form of relief, that is, the diminution of the estate assets on the same theory as is asserted by AHR. The only distinction is the title that is given to it and then the description of the cause of action, but it is otherwise the same. It is based on the idea, the contention, I should say, that Lizowitz Heller combined with North Mill and Ivan Jeffrey to in some way make a sale that was for less than all full value for its assets. Now, there's no merit to those claims. We originally got the claims dismissed by the district court on the basis of on a 12b-6 because it failed to state a cause of action, and then there was an amended complaint which didn't materially change anything, and then we ended up in this lengthy process with respect to going to bankruptcy court and then dealing with the standing issue. But in any event, it is not the situation that AHR can simultaneously present these claims along with the trustee, because they'd be lost standing. If it had standing, it lost it once the bankruptcy was filed. The district court reviews very comprehensively the law with respect to that issue.
In the bankruptcy, that cause of action in the bankruptcy court stand of Artesian's claim that you say is presently before the trust, before the bankruptcy court, and it's the exact same claim that Artesian makes in the district court. What is the standing in the bankruptcy court?
The trustee
that claim.
The trustee pursued claims against my clients to recover for the exact same amounts that are at issue here. That is, that there was a sale that was for less than full value of the assets at a time when the sale could have been for more to some other party.
And the same theory? The trustee used the same theory?
Yes, he didn't call it the same description, but the theory is that the lawyers some way participated with their client, which is not something I think that is actionable, but that's, we raised that issue, but that the assets of Wilton Armitel were sold for less than full value to a particular purchaser at a time when there was another opportunity to sell it for full value or for a greater value, which then deprived the estate of the full value of the non-real estate assets, which is exactly the claim pursued by AHR.
I'm going.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Your Honor.
What is the bankruptcy court doing with that claim at this time? Where does that stand?
Well, I don't – that claim has been prosecuted by the trustee. Discovery has come to a essentially to a conclusion, except for the trustee decided to try to abandon the claim.
Oh, so that claim was never adjudicated in the bankruptcy court?
Well, not yet, because it's been prosecuted.
You say it was abandoned.
No, it has not. Excuse me, Your Honor. It has not been abandoned. It has absolutely not been abandoned. And here,
well, wasn't adjudicated either, you say?
Let me explain. Presently before the bankruptcy court, though I don't believe this is at all material to the disposition of this appeal, presently before the bankruptcy court is the trustee's motion to abandon the claim. We held a hearing. There was a hearing on that, at which Lizowitz Eller participated and asserted an objection to the request to abandon. The bankruptcy court has not made a decision on the trustee's motion with respect to the abandon. But remember, that motion, just to be clear, is not to abandon its claim to AHR. It is to abandon the claim to the debtor. So as at this point in time, AHR has no basis for standing because it lost it once the bankruptcy was filed, and it hasn't since regained it. It didn't regain it by the stipulation, which has nothing to do with a claim against abandoning claims against my clients, and it didn't abandon anything whatsoever to AHR. Now, the plaintiff, as I understand it, has his third position, which is that it was abandoned as a matter of law. Well, that can't be right either. It can't be right because the trustee pursued the claim. You can't reconcile the two. Well, two positions. Okay, you can't possibly reconcile them.
Well, Mr. Kern, I take the plaintiff's best argument to be that there are two particular claims that were specifically not abandoned, negligence, professional liability, and breach of contract. So maybe the implication is all other claims against Lizowitz Eller were abandoned because they're not spelled out there. That, what would your response be to that?
My response is that's not what it says in the app. You can't make any assumption that the fact that there's just mention of these particular claims, that means any other claim is abandoned. But importantly, let's keep this in mind. Without regard, again, for the title that you give the claim, the concept is the same. It is the nature of the relief that is being pursued. The relief was not abandoned. The theory behind this is that, well, the trustee is not chasing it. That's not true. The trustee is chasing it. The trustee is chasing it, trying to recover from Lizowitz Eller the same amounts that are at issue here, the same amounts that it represented to the bankruptcy court to employ special counsel to pursue, was of the same value as is described in this case, and the same amount that was then described in the self-executing or voluntary disclosures that were made as part of discovery in the case by the trustee. And the trustee pursued it. The trustee took depositions. The trustee engaged in written discovery. The trustee has produced documents. The trustee has demanded materials from us. The trustee has conducted depositions of my clients. So it is the form of relief. It is not the title. That's why I started with the idea that the first standing test is particularized harm, not particularized claim. It is particularized harm. And the harm that's involved is exactly the same as is being pursued by the trustee, which is now subjecting, if this case is allowed to go forward by AHR, will subject my client to duplicate liability, which can't possibly be the purpose, because at that point, then, there's no abandonment. Think about how that works. You're going to abandon the claim. I'm going to abandon the claim, but I'm going to pursue the same form of relief. How is that possibly – how can you reconcile that concept? You're abandoning the concept behind abandonment is you're abandoning the opportunity to pursue that relief. That's what you're abandoning, not abandoning a title to a cause of action. You're abandoning the form of relief so that there isn't multiple parties chasing the same form of relief. Here, there's multiple parties chasing the same form of relief.
But the bankruptcy court has not adjudicated the claim that was made, according to what you told me. That you said they were pursuing it, but there's never been any adjudication.
It's not there yet, Your Honor. With the trustee has asked for and obtained extensions of the schedule. I mean, the case has been on a case management. You know, it's had a Rule 16 order in place since a long time ago, and is being pursued. The court recently amended the some of the deadlines. It did not restore the discovery deadlines. The trustee is in this limbo position about the expert witness deadline. And the court further extended the deadline pending the decision with respect to the trustee's motion to abandon, which, again, lies with our opposed.
But the trustee, the stipulation and settlement agreement expressly stated that the trustee would not interfere with the assertion by Artesian of the abandoned claims.
Just quite frankly, that's just being legally cute, right? That's all that is. Sure, what does the trustee care if somebody else pursues the same thing and gets double payment from the single source, gets the same form of relief? How can the trustee control that? That's not up to the trustee to do. He's not the trustee didn't say, and I abandon that form of relief. And if that's the situation, then how do they reconcile the two positions? Because the trustee is pursuing that. My client has had to defend duplicate causes of action by two different parties in the court for the same activity. That can't possibly be the purpose of this whole concept of standing and abandonment. It can't be. You can't subject my client for a duplicate recovery for the same conduct. Only one of them gets the money, if they're even.
Even though the trustee said he's abandoned the claims by Artesian Northern Data.
He has not. Judge, you continue to say that the trustee has said he's abandoned the claim. That's not
true. I said that, too. That's
only not true. That's why I'm trying, don't.
We're saying it would not interfere with the assertion by Artesian.
I don't know what that means. He's not that sure. If he can collect the judgment against Liza Whittell or Watson and then the trustee can go collect it again, I'm sure he won't. What does he care? But that's not. This is distorted thinking by Mr. Golden in his presentation to suggest that this has been, that the form of relief was abandoned by the trustee. It was not. It was absolutely not. And whatever the non-interference means, okay, so they're each in it for themselves. That's all this means. They're each in it for themselves. I won't bother you. You don't bother me. Okay, so what they're doing is they're both attacking my client simultaneously to pursue the exact same form of relief for exactly the same conduct during the same time period, meaning that it was all the same activity and all having to do with a sale for less of full value of the assets, of the non-real estate assets. So somehow Mr. Golden has convinced you that the trustee abandoned the form of relief in some writing, and that's not true. And if it's true, then it means that the trustee is acting illegally. And if that was the case, he wouldn't have been bothering to go through discovery, to pursue my client, to take the depositions, to travel to New York and to travel other places to do the third-party witnesses, which included the former employees of the bank, at North Mill, along with the former employees of Wilton Armitage, the debtor, and my clients. The trustee has asserted in a petition that considerable resources were spent. I think they told the bankruptcy judge that they spent $40,000 in expenses. So it's not the situation that has been abandoned. It's being legally cute. They're saying, you know, that the trustee isn't going to interfere. That's not abandonment. And then they say abandonment, but they point you to a stipulation that doesn't abandon anything whatsoever to AHR. It abandoned it to the debtor. AHR wants to say, well, it can't abandon it to the debtor because those claims never belong to the debtor. Well, that may be – that's an interesting construction, but it's not what the stipulation indicates. And there's no court adjudication on the idea that abandoning to the debtor is the same as abandoning to AHR. So going back to the original issue, they didn't – AHR lost whatever standing it had for some of the claims and its form of relief as soon as bankruptcy was filed, and it hasn't regained standing to pursue those claims. I hope I've been successful at answering the questions, straightening it out. It's been a long wait to get to this point for me to be
able to. I know you've been successful in generating questions that I have for Mr. Golden.
Am I on now?
Okay. Mr. Golden, you have no other questions. I don't hear anybody asking you. Go ahead, Mr. Golden. You deserve 4 minutes, I think.
Okay, can I, Your Honor, add one thing? And as the district court pointed out in its opinion, which is that the trustee cannot abandon relief in favor of any particular creditor, which is what's happened here. On the theory, not that it's actually happened, but that that's the position that AHR is taking, that there was, that the relief was abandoned to it, meaning it favored them as a creditor, which the district court said is not allowed. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Mr. Golden, this kind of, at least for my, Justin McKee, for my benefit, help me with the whole confusion of abandonment, because I also used that term, and I didn't think there was any dispute about that, that the fact the trustee was not pursuing the claiming issue in my mind then became what happened to it. Your friend has raised the issue of whatever happened should not be termed an abandonment. So maybe you can clarify that up for me.
Sure. But can I answer that in part by referring you to a part of the record?
Sure.
8463.
8463?
That's correct.
Joint Appendix 463. Yep, got it.
Paragraph 16. And in particular, the last sentence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, I got it. Go ahead.
Okay. When Mr. McCarran just spoke, he said, well, you can't have these two sets of claims because they're for the same set of relief. And the trustee clearly says they're not. In fact, up on the top of the page, excuse me, there's a list of the claims that Artisanius is bringing. They aren't the claims that are being brought by the trustee. Now, he then raises the possibility of a double recovery. And we all know double recoveries aren't permitted. But we also don't know that the trustee will succeed in his claims. And the argument Mr. McCarran is therefore making is, well, it doesn't matter whether the trustee succeeds or not in his claim. If the trustee's bringing a claim, Artisanius can't, even though they're on different causes of action. And that's just not true. If, for instance, the trustee loses, or the trustee decides not to pursue his claim, or the trustee's motion to abandon the claim, which is currently before the bankruptcy court, doesn't go anywhere, Artisanius would still be able to pursue its claims. Now, as to the issue of abandonment, there are three different possibilities here. The first is that the trustee never got the claims to begin with, which is what the trustee has taken as his position against Leisowitz Heller. That they belong to Artisanius, they don't belong to the trustee. But the second is, as we've been through previously, there was a compromise, a Rule 19 compromise agreement, which was heard by the court on motion by the trustee. The trustee, exercising his discretion, decides that he doesn't want to pursue the claims that Artisanius is already bringing in district court. And that compromise agreement is approved by the bankruptcy court. That's a done deal. And I think one of you made a comment before the equivalent of, it is a done deal, and yes, it is. And we have no reason now why we should be reopening that final order of the bankruptcy court. And then this is the third time when the trustee again tries to abandon the claims other than the malpractice and breach of contract claim. And if you go back to the stipulation, his original motion, he's abandoning all claims except the malpractice and breach of contract claims. So the trustee has three times tried not to bring these claims and wants Artisanius to bring them. And part of the reason the trustee does is because if Artisanius succeeds, that will reduce Artisanius' claims against the bankruptcy estate. So the trustee has a real interest in seeing that happen.
But the estate, you control Wilton now, and so I wonder whether we think the trustee has an independent judgment here on 8463 that there are, in fact, separate claims, or whether the trustee is more maybe partial to your side.
I don't think so. I wish. No, because Wilton, the trustee has been completely arm's length at Wilton. Wilton is, there's nothing there. It was denuded. Other than whatever claims were abandoned to it, there's nothing there. I don't know whether that answers your question or not. I hope so. If not, I wanted to speak a little bit then about the notion of a direct injury.
Go ahead.
That again gets to the notion that only Artisanius had a judgment lien recorded. Yes, it was unique. And it was the basis of that uniqueness that compelled the Chapter 7 trustee to enter into the compromise agreement, in which he permitted Artisanius to pursue its claims. So, at the end of the day, we come back to the points I tried to make at the very beginning, which is the trustee had a discretion, just as any business manager does, in how he will deal with the assets of the estate. In this case, it was the most important asset was the real estate at that point in time. And the compromises he will make to be able to sell the real estate. And in this case, it was a compromise where Artisanius took less than it wanted, but in exchange, it was permitted to go ahead with its claims against North Mill and Leisowitz Heller and others. And that was the deal. That was the deal everyone got notice of. That was the deal that went before the bankruptcy court. That was the deal in which the North Mill appeared. Leisowitz Heller could have appeared. Didn't. But North Mill, and that's the deal when North Mill's counsel got up and said, in response to the judge failing, where I said the releases in the North Mill carve-out agreement don't impact anything. There's nothing in this. ARH isn't releasing anything. There's nothing in that settlement that forecloses ARH's claims against North Mill. The court says, I don't know of any that would. Let me ask Mr. Israel, do you think there's anything? Mr. Israel says, there's nothing. They could go forward with, you know, we don't see a long tail to that, but they could go forward with what they've got in federal court by all means. And the court then says, you have the parties that particularly agree, the trustee and North Mill, saying they agree with your position that your litigation is not compromised by what is happening here today, by anything that happened today. And I don't know, you know, when we stand in front of a court and we're having that colloquy, I don't know how we make it clearer. I don't know how many judges could be clearer.
Anyway, I think we understand your viewpoint, Mr. Coleman. And thank you for your patience and the thoroughness with which you presented your respective sides and answered our questions. Unless my colleagues have any questions, we'll take that under advisement. I would like to get a transcript. And Mr. Keene, if you speak with him, can explain how to arrange to get a transcript, and you should split the cost of that transcript.
Super.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can I point out to the court that the stipulation doesn't use the word accept? The stipulation, Mr. Golden.
Look at the stipulation right now. Yeah, you can do that in the 28J letter. This is going to be Jarndyce versus fine. Jarndyce pretty soon. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is Mr. Keene still on the line, or?
I think, I don't know who's on the line. I assume Mr.
Okay, Keene. Then I will call back Mr. Keene later.
Yeah, you can call Keene K, and give him a call, and he can explain that to
super. Thank you so much. Take
care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.